paper.
Welcome to episode 87 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Kelly Anderson, a designer and paper engineer whose work operates in the space between conceptual art, graphic design, and tech. Her whimsical books have featured a working paper planetarium, a pop-up pinhole camera, and a paper record player. Whenever she can, she uses humble, lo-fi materials to expose the invisible magic of the world and make abstract concepts real and tangible. Kelly's work puts forth the idea that lo-fi, handheld experiences can challenge the notion of tech as an inaccessible black box. Her first book, a functional pop-up camera titled This Book is a Camera, was published by the Museum of Modern Art in 2016. Her paper record player, Invitation, her TED Talk, and her work on Tiny Bop's The Human Body are widely beloved for showcasing the possibility hiding in plain view in our world. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Kelly Anderson, welcome to Paper Talk. I'm so excited to talk to you.
I'm always excited to talk to you, Helen. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I want to hear a little bit about where you grew up and what you did as a child that was creative and led to your interest in paper and tech and everything else.
I don't know if I have like a really great narrative for that. So I grew up in New Orleans, and we moved to a suburb called Mandeville when I was in second grade, which is sort of like across Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans. But I always felt a really deep connection to New Orleans. Like my dad's mother, I was really super close to that particular grandmother, and her family goes back generations from New Orleans. So she's a true New Orleans lady. And I think I spent a lot of time at her house doing, kind of absurd arts and crafts. Like I remember we made like 25 little pillows for some bunny rabbits we had. So we were always, as she would say, oh, we were always involved in some good nonsense. So I think maybe I got a lot of my tinkering and sort of, that sense of like, oh, well, if you want to make things in the world, you just make them. I think I got a lot of that from her. But my mom studied to become a nurse, but then became a homemaker. And my dad's a riverboat pilot in New Orleans. So he's like really into the river and boats and fishing. And if he's not like working on a boat, he's like out in the Gulf, like fishing on a boat. So I'm mildly interested in boats. Like I'm definitely, it's fascinating what he does, but I wouldn't want to spend every waking moment on a boat. So I did not follow his footsteps. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Oh, cool. So don't people from New Orleans pronounce it a little differently? Have you changed the way you say it or...
Yeah, I'm from New Orleans, darling. Okay.
Hey, I grew up in Texas, and I don't think I have a Southern accent, so
I don't detect Texas. Yeah,
I know.
Where are you from in Texas?
Bryan College Station. My dad was a professor at Texas A&M.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I think my problem was I grew up like watching nature documentaries obsessively. So I think I kind of like took on, who was it, like John Forsythe or, like my accent was very confused.
Right. So interesting. Where did you go to college and grad school and all of that?
Yeah. So when I was in high school, I split my time between an arts magnet school in New Orleans called NOCA. and my academic high school. And so I already knew from like a young age that like I wanted to be an artist in some capacity. And so I was on that track, and I went to undergrad in state because there was like a really good like tuition assistance program. So I went to the University of Louisiana, which was a great school, and I learned so much, but I was also, you know, 18, 19 years old and very eager to get out of Louisiana. So I graduated like super early and came to New York to go to grad school at Pratt. And then at Pratt, I applied for studio art because I wanted studio space, and I wanted the sort of like ambiguous, like, what am I doing here ticket that would like get me into the photography department, the printmaking department, you know, have studio space. So I just signed up for studio art.
I just want to ask a question about high school. So was that unusual to split between the two, or was a normal thing? Was it two different schools, academic and art? Is that what you said?
Two different schools. And so it's pretty common with magnet schools. Okay. So NOCA, it's called New Orleans Creative Center for the Arts. They have like a really, really great music program. Their art program is great too. So it was split between like 2D design, 3D design. We had like a clay studio. We had a photography studio. So it was kind of like the experience that most people have in their first or second year in art school. So it was, I mean, it's unusual in that like my normal academic high school like felt like prison in that, like, you know, you were not supposed to be roaming the halls. You definitely weren't supposed to be in the parking lot, like in between classes and stuff. And so by me being able to say like, oh, I'm going to NOCA, my magnet school, it was kind of like a free pass to never get in trouble, which was like very, very nice.
And then how did you know you wanted to be an artist? Like, do you have a memory of when that was, and even that you knew that that could be a career?
I'm not really sure. I remember when I was in kindergarten, or maybe it was earlier, maybe it was preschool. I got disqualified for some drawing competition because they said I couldn't have made the drawing myself. And I think it was a big deal in my family. Mm-hmm. Like my parents kind of like staged a protest and stuff. And so I think that, I also got glasses for the first time when I was in kindergarten. Like, I'm very nearsighted. I'm like -8 in both eyes. And they didn't figure that out until, I think it was like the first time I went to the zoo on a field trip, and everyone was like, oh, look at the turtle. And I'm like, what turtle? And so there was, I was good enough at drawing before kindergarten that they were able to like detect a change in my drawing skills from like before I had glasses and after I got glasses. And so all of the trees were these sort of like bulbous things and then started to have leaves afterwards. So I was just like I've always really, really been into both like drawing things and making things, and then also books and reading. So those have been two like very consistent features of my life. And that just sort of led me into like getting deeper and deeper into, like, when I was in high school, I got super into cultural things that were kind of like at the intersection of like what artists do and what publishers do. So I was like really into like independent publishing and zines and record album art and stuff like that. So I think that really sealed the deal in terms of me like being an artist.
Right. And that's cool that you had that high school there. I'm jealous.
So cool.
I took like architectural drawing with a bunch of boys at my high school, which had a technical department, you know, where people could learn how to fix tractors and that kind of work. I don't even know the names of those classes, but I'm just having a flashback. And I was very out of place in this architectural drawing class, but I was good. So I got attention from the teacher and I don't know. Anyways, so I interrupted you talking about Pratt and moving to New York. And I guess at your art high school, you probably had heard about schools like this. Why did you choose Pratt? Did you want to go to New York City or, and you're still in New York City, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I did. I really, really wanted to go to New York City. So I kind of, I skipped one step. After I got out of high school, I did a pre-college program at the Art Institute of Chicago. Oh. And liked that. I mean, any sort of setting that was an art school, I felt at home. Mm-hmm. So that was a good experience. When I was in undergrad school in Louisiana, I was like so craving going to New York that my parents sort of conceded and let me come up to the School of Visual Arts for like a summer painting program. So I did that and got more credits. And so I really had my eye on like getting into like an environment that was more like full-time art school and less, you know, university. My mom's whole side of the family, they're all from Brooklyn. And my grandfather on my mom's side was like a Con Edison man his whole life. If anyone's from here, you probably have had some experience with Con Ed. But yeah, I just like grew up like hearing them like sing show tunes and just like, you know, yell at me in terms that I now can identify as like Yiddishisms. So like I grew up like with a lot of like Yiddish stuff, like from my grandparents who were very like Italian old school New Yorkers. So I feel like culturally, like I had a bit of, you know, like by the time I was like 6 years old, I was hearing about how egg creams were like the best things in the world. And like, they're really not, but, you know, I was definitely like brought up like with those values that like New York was the center of the universe and that was the place to go. And, I haven't quite shaken that yet. I know I've traveled a lot. There are a lot of beautiful places I love going to, but there's somehow I've been like emotionally pre-programmed to like believe that like New York is the place to be.
Yeah, I moved there after college and I have to say I just had visited and loved it and decided I was going to move to New York. And I never thought I would leave, but I did. So I hear you. It's a great place. It's a great place. So you were saying you went to Pratt and you thought you would be in studio art, but it sounded like maybe you were in a different department or.
No.
I
signed up for studio art strategically though, because like I wanted my own studio and I was always thinking about like, okay, like what are like the material conditions of what I'll have access to? And like, if I went into something more specific, like photography, then I'd have no business being over in like the ceramic studio. But if you say that you're going for studio art, then you can do whatever. So I really took advantage of that. And I was a teacher's assistant for a silkscreen class. And I was working on like mostly painting and collage and drawing, but ended up like having most of my friends over in the photography department. So it was really fun time for me.
Yeah. And is that where you got interested in paper at Pratt or?
Not really. Like I started at Pratt. I realized that you could get a dual master's in art history if you added like 20 credit hours. So I did that. And all the while, I think my friends kept on looking at me as like the person who they wanted to work with on different projects. So I had a lot of friends who were like getting married and friends who were in bands that needed posters and stuff. And so my friends would be like, hey, Kelly, like, can you work on a wedding invitation for me? And I didn't realize this at the time, but like all of that stuff was design work. And I didn't really like identify as a designer. I didn't know what design was. But I took on this one project, this wedding invitation project, my friends, Mike and Karen, where I pitched them this idea that I saw in Mr. Wizard, which was that we should make a paper record player for their wedding invitation.
Now, wait, we're tell, all just like, I want to hear about Mr. Wizard, because that must be after my time. Because I listened to your TED Talk, by the way, we'll put a link to this. Oh, cool, I think that's where you mentioned Mr. Wizard, or somewhere online I saw that. Yeah, and that was when you were a kid, and then it turned into this real project that I think a lot of people have heard about and kind of put you on the map, maybe. So, yeah, tell me about that show first.
Okay, so Mr. Wizard, it's funny because, like, okay, so Mr. Wizard aired, I think, from like the 60s to the 80s. And then I grew up in Louisiana, and I think that our PBS like had like showed like a lot of reruns that went on like a lot later than a lot of the other places in the US. But Mr. Wizard was the show where this guy named Mr. Wizard would do these science experiments with kids. And he wasn't particularly nice. I think that's something that there's like a YouTube remix of him on in these episodes. It's called, if you Google Mr. Wizard is a Dick, you'll see him like yelling at children over and over again. But he really did make things magic too. And like one of the magic things that I saw him do was he like, you know, took this piece of paper, rolled it up to a cone, and taped a needle to it. And that was enough to be able to amplify those little grooves on a record that normally make no sound into audibility. And so Mike and Karen, they wanted a wedding invitation. They wanted it to be about music because Mike's a sound engineer and Karen, Karen at the time went by the name Dork DJ. She's like a very, very serious open source like activist lawyer, but she also like DJ'd, and so we're like, okay, cool, let's try to do this. And they had memories of the Mr. Wizard episode too, and all of us remembered this. We're like, okay, well, this is something we have to try to do. And so after that, when I put together this paper record player, I shot a video of it that was nicely lit. I put it on the internet, and it must have been a slow news day or something, because it like went crazy viral. Like the wedding people loved it, the record collector people loved it. It like got scooped up for like morning time TV shows and like bride blogs, and so it really, really took off. And I liked working with my hands and I liked working with paper, but I didn't consider myself like an origami artist or a paper engineer or anything. But I just realized that there was something there, there was something like in our time of like super advanced tech that was like just very mystical and very cool about a single piece of paper with a needle taped to it that could work as a piece of technology. And so it was really that sort of like conceptual question that like led me down the craft rabbit hole. I know most people are the opposite way, where they start, you know, just get the bug of like paper folding, you don't go down the hole, but I started in the other way, where I was like, oh, this is an interesting question to me, and then had to learn the paper skills, which was actually super fun too. So
yeah, that's so cool. And so what platform did that take off from? Did you post a video on YouTube or Instagram, or?
I think it was just Twitter. I don't even think I had an Instagram account at this time. So I think I posted it to Twitter. Yeah. I mean, for full disclosure, like a couple different design blogs had featured previous projects. Like I made that, I think you saw that handkerchief wedding invitation for my friends, Jacob and Yunga. And that kind of made the rounds. People thought that was really cute. And I was like, ooh, I like this kind of attention. So I made sure intentionally to like do a very good job of documenting this project, because I was like, I don't know, maybe other people will like this, but I was definitely surprised by the response I got.
Yeah. And what about your blog? When did that start? Was that before or after?
Yeah, that was before. So I started the blog maybe in 2006 or 2007. Right when I realized that it was fun to, that was around the time when I realized it was fun to like talk to people on the internet, like to post your projects, to you know, see what people have to say about them. And then also to share process. Because I personally, I find things more interesting. Well, they're sort of like, I want more granularity that I can dig into. Like if I find something interesting, like I want to appreciate it like aesthetically first, I want to look into it a little bit more deeply second, but then like, I want somewhere for that energy to go. Like I want to be able to read like a 10,000 word blog post about like, where did this thing come from? Like, where is it cited within like the history of ideas? What is it in conversation with? Like, how did you make it? Like, what was the procedure? What glue did you use? You know, I get kind of obsessive. And so I wanted to give my own projects that kind of treatment so that other people could interact with them deeply, but also could, you know, if they were inspired by it, then they could like pick up some piece of what I was doing and like go run with it. So I started writing about everything in very long form writing on the blog. And I haven't updated my site since then. So it's a little embarrassing on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm impressed by how much I've written over the years about like my work and process.
Yeah. Listeners, you should go take a look. And I was going to mention that. Yeah. It doesn't look like you're actively doing that anymore, but it's a wonderful resource. And lots of thinking going on there. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you do the record player after college? And I know you do freelance gigs now. Did you ever have a real job? Sort of what?
Not really. Okay. I mean, I don't want to sell them too short. Like right when I got out of grad school, I started working at the American Museum of Natural History and their library. So they have an amazing library. And in particular, the special collections department is really cool because they have like a lot of like John James Audubon's like original, like rare books. And, you know, old astronomy books from like the 1500s that have vowels and stuff in them. So they have like super cool stuff. I was mostly responsible for digitizing their glass plate negative collection, which has a lot of these, you know, I'm holding in my hand these glass plate negatives, which are like objects that traveled on the first expedition to the South Pole. So there's a lot of like, do not drop anything.
Yeah.
Anxiety. but also like, it was great just getting out of grad school because I felt like this very heavy responsibility of like, okay, well, how do we preserve these things that like every single day are decaying more? You know, like what's the best, you know, system of metadata for it? You know, what's the material needs for its preservation? And so I was really excited to be there. So that was part-time. And so I basically went in Monday through Friday for a couple hours every day and got to ride my bike from Park Slope over to the Natural History Museum. So I got some exercise, scanned some negatives, talked about metadata, and then I'd go home and like obsess over design at night. So I'd like work on projects for my friends. Like all my client jobs, like early on, were just like friends who had projects. And that's the great thing about being in New York. It's like one friend had a cable access TV show. Another friend had a band. Other friends were getting married. You know, another friend had like a small magazine. And like everyone always needs something. So you can kind of bartered with them. And I was like, well, I need an outlet for doing what I want to do. And if you give that to me, then I will either not charge you or we can like trade or something. So.
Right. And you mentioned vowels, and I know you did this existential calculator. And so at some point you went out on your own, I think. And tell me about the existential calculator and the thinking behind it. And
The reason I think I first heard about vowels in grad school, like, and not from grad school itself, but because I was an avid reader of Cabinet magazine. I don't know if you've seen that one, but Cabinet magazine, it's like, it just kind of like, there's a lot of, it's sort of, just weird little tidbits from like history and like art history. I think it's geared towards artists, but it's mostly like a history publication. But I think I had seen them first there and just became increasingly interested in the idea of like a paper calculator, like really appealed to me because I really like that idea of like, oh, this thing contains logic and I'm able to make decisions with it, but that logic is structured physically was just very interesting to me. So
describe what a Voval is real quick. And then,
oh yeah, just of course. So a Voval, it can take on a couple different forms, but they're always circular and they always rotate to hide and reveal information. So the first Vovals appeared in like astronomy books from like the 1400s and 1500s, where people were trying to figure out like and make predictable like the motions of the night sky. And they became pretty popular in like the 1940s and 1950s in America as like an advertising device. And so you could turn them and you could stack a bunch of concentric wheels on top of each other and turn them and have the user essentially turn the wheels to answer a series of questions and then output a specific answer. So, I mean, they were kind of like slide rules, but circular. But they're fun because it's a dumb piece of paper in a way, but it'll surprise you because, you know, just by answering a couple questions, you can like really hone in on like what a person needs to hear. Which was sort of the basis of this existential calculator. Cause I had, at that point in time, I had so many freelance jobs being thrown at me that I was like, I need some kind of like system to decide like what's going to be a good job and what's going to be a bad job. And so I made the existential calculator mostly for myself, to be able to, basically tell myself what I already knew about these jobs, you know, so I could confidently say like, yes, I will take this job and throw myself into it, or no, I don't need that. And so the premise is that there's four basic questions on the wheels and you turn the wheels to answer those questions. And they're all kind of on a scale. So one is like, what are the working conditions? And the working conditions go from like very bad to very good. Same thing with pay, same thing with fit. Same thing with ethics of like, you know, is this good for the world or bad for the world? And so the combination of those four factors gives you like a pretty reasonable idea of like what's going to happen if you take on a job. So yeah, that's what my little funny Voval does.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what was one of the an interesting gig that your Voval told you to take? Did you use it for the Talking While Female project? Just curious.
Oh, yeah, I did. So what Helen's referring to is there's a project I worked on for NPR that was called Talking While Female. And this was an animation gig that I did a paper animation for. And it's all about like how we unfairly judge other people's voices, but in particular, other women's voices. And so it was great because it was interviews with all of these different NPR correspondents who have been working in the sphere their whole life and have been told by countless commentators that there's something wrong with their voice, that their voice is annoying, that it's too high, that they sound like Kardashian, all of this stuff. And so there was new research that had come out about, I guess like sociological research about like this phenomenon of judging other people's voices and like what we respond to negatively and positively. And so they wanted to create this little segment with an animation. And I remember it was very short timeline. So the working conditions were not great. It was a perfect fit for me. I was very excited about doing it. I felt like it was good for the world. Like this was a conversation that people weren't really having. Like we were talking about, you know, other types of like bias and bigotry, but we weren't really talking about voice. So I felt like it was a real mission. So it didn't even really matter to me like what the existential calculator said. I was going to take that job because I felt very, very spiritually like sort of like aligned with it and very excited to do it. Which is
yeah.
And really my main criteria.
Right. Yeah. How did you get that gig? You were talking about your circle of friends. I'm just curious whether it came through that, or did someone from NPR see something you'd done, or do you even know?
Yeah, it's really, this is the funny, murky thing about the internet and why. So just to like zoom out just a little bit, like I feel like in interviews, like I'll get questions about like, oh, well, how are you successful? Or how do you get these jobs or whatever? And I have to be honest and say, like, I don't completely know. And I think a lot of it does have to do with luck that my early career, I was working for a lot of friends, but a lot of those friends went on to, you know, found like award-winning educational companies for children and make successful documentaries and stuff like that. And so I kind of lucked out just by having people in my vicinity who were, I kind of like traveled with, you know, like my community was pretty solid. And so I didn't personally know the people who hired me for NPR, but I did have, you know, friends who were working at NPR at the time. And so it's quite possible that they put my work in front of one of the journalists who was working on this story. So that's to say, like, I think my impulse as it didn't seem super professional at the time. Like I was very good at like turning down any job that felt like corporate or like well-paying. I just like kept on doing things that I was excited about, which was mostly stuff that my friends were working on. And, that was probably more a choice of privilege rather than wisdom, because I didn't feel like I had to take on the corporate jobs. I felt like everything's going to be okay. And I can like stitch together these small paychecks and make it work. And not everyone has that experience. Since I went to undergraduate school completely for free because of scholarships, I think I was able to emerge debt free. And a lot of people do not have that leisure, especially these days. It's just gotten more and more expensive to go to school. So anyway. Yeah.
I love that you say that, because I feel a similar sort of freedom myself, a privilege, like you're saying. And I was stupid early in my career, probably, and how little money I was making and the choices I made. But I think there's really something to say about following your passion, and it is a wonderful privilege to be able to do that, because you do your best work if you're following your passion, I think. So
I think at some point in time, like I calculated how much I was making on a certain job, and I was like, oh, I made like $3 an hour.
Yeah.
Like, right. It's a privilege to be able to do that. You know, like you can't do that if you have $100,000 in student loans.
Right.
So, it's kind of, for years, like I would tell people in interviews, it was like, I don't know. I don't care about money. I don't like to think about it. I'm probably like a little bit reckless with money, but you know, it all works out in the end. And I realize now, like in retrospect, I can look back at that sort of mentality and realize that like that's sort of like the best case scenario, you know, like that is a privileged position to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me just about the paper animations you did, sort of technically how you produced the Talking While Female piece.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, just to back up, or zoom out a bit, like my friend, Raul and Yunga, they founded a company called Tiny Bot that was making apps for children. And so I animated an app for them, which was called The Human Body, where I had to draw, I don't know, 270 different drawings of like organs, which is kind of my worst nightmare as a hypochondriac, but I got through it. I drew the lungs, I drew the heart, I drew everything. And then I had gotten a Craft Robo, which is like a computerized plotter cutter, sometime during this project, because they were paying me and I was like, all right, what do I want to spend my money on? I need to get more art stuff. And so I decided that since I had all these drawings of body parts, that I would make my friends this like paper corpse. You know, I'd cut out the heart and lungs and all of this stuff, and I'd put it together in like a layered corpse body, you know, like, and so I did that, and once it was done, I was like, oh my gosh, this thing wants to move. Like, this is so, it looks so fun. And like, I felt like all the parts needed to move around. And so I, without even asking my friends, I just like shot this paper stop motion trailer for their app that I just drew, like using this paper body. And it was amazing. Like, it was, it turned out so well. They used it for like the official thing. It got like featured on Radiolab. It got, you know, like it kind of like made the rounds. Like, it was a successful thing. And so I started doing more like paper stop motion animation professionally. And of course, like once I was doing it professionally, it was kind of less fun, but I did jobs for Third Man Records. Like, we produced a video about how records are made, and then I made the video for NPR Talking All Female, and worked on another very long term, like a 6 months project for Tiny Bop, to make a paper stop motion trailer for another app called Plants. So I think those are all the paper stop motion. I think at that point I got kind of burnt out on it because it was just like so much tedious work, but that's how the paper stop motion came to be.
Okay, cool. And yeah, there's a great video. I think it's on your blog website about the plants, the making of the plants piece. So listeners, you should go check it out. Yeah. And you have a couple of publications. The book is a camera and this book is a planetarium. Tell us a little bit about those, how those came to be. Like, did you?
Yeah,
you tell me.
Yeah. So this book is a camera. They're very literal titles. So this book is a camera is a pop-up book that works as a functioning camera, but it's all paper. So like, there's no lenses or anything. It's just a black box with a hole in it that you put photo paper into it. So, and same thing with this book is a planetarium. So it has a miniature pop-up planetarium that you can like use your smartphone flashlight or a normal flashlight and project stars on your ceiling. And then there are five other tech devices that are made out of paper within that book. And my life, I realized how much of my life is just completely random things. But these books came about because someone from Chronicle Books reached out to me and they wanted me to do the illustrations for another book. So they're publishing this other book. They needed to hire an illustrator. And they said, oh, Kelly, we have this project that would be an excellent fit for you. And I like looked at the brief and it like didn't feel like a good fit for me at all. It was kind of like weird motivational quotes and like country crafts or something. It was not, I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. It just didn't feel, I had a brief moment of like, am I representing myself wrong in the universe that like people think this is a great fit for me? But I sat with it for a couple of days and I was like, you know, there, I want to make a book. Like, I want to make my own book. Like, I could do this. And so I wrote back to them and said, I politely declined, but I mentioned that I had other book ideas. And they said, oh, well, we'd love to hear your idea. And so I went into crazy overdrive and that weekend built some like very rudimentary pop-up paper devices and shot videos of all of them, took photos of all of them, and like wrote a proposal for, at the time I was calling it, this book is a blank, you know, like a fill in the blank. And they're like, oh, well, we don't do a lot of pop-up books. They're really expensive to make, but you know, I'll show this to the board and see what they think. And the board really loved the idea. And so then, you know, they wrote up a contract and we started making it. But one of the books that I, or one of the spreads that I pitched for this book was a pop-up camera. And even though it worked really well, they thought, you know, they said like, we don't think people are actually going to want to use this because it's too much trouble. You have to do darkroom photography. It's just like, it's too much. And so I, at that time, Adobe had just given me this artist residency for an entire year that they were going to give me a salary. And so I decided I could be a little bit reckless with my money and just decided to self-publish the camera book. So I went to Structural Graphics, who are in Connecticut. They make like a lot of cool pop-up cards and mailers. And I said, what about we do this book together? And could you print this? And we needed in an unreasonably short amount of time, because we won it for Adobe Max, which is Adobe's big conference. And they said yes. And so I got 3,000 of them printed and tried to like do really good, careful documentation. Like I made a fun video about it, took a lot of like photos and stuff, and didn't leak out any information ahead of time, just sort of like went on the blog and on social media and were like, was like, hey, I made this thing, look at it. And people were really excited about it. Like Wired named it like one of their best tech objects of the year. And I was like, ooh, yes, this is definitely a tech object. But yeah, after it was out for a little while, the Museum of Modern Art got in touch and they wanted to republish it for their design store. And so I didn't have a problem with that. Like I love MoMA. And so I was really excited to have them republish it.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to let you know that my new book, The Art of Papercraft, is now out in the world. The book offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can order that directly from me at HelenHebertStudio.com. And if the autograph doesn't matter to you, the book is available wherever fine books are sold. It's also available on Kindle. And by the way, my book, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, has also just been released on Kindle. And my other papermaking book, The Papermaker's Companion, has been available on Kindle for a couple of years. Now back to our conversation.
That's so cool. And I want to just comment on what you said at the beginning about how the project came about, because that is my experience with publishing as well. I was really fortunate that an editor reached out to me early in my career and asked me if I wanted to write a book. I was qualified, but not an expert, and, you know, just roundabout. And I did take that project, but later on, another editor approached me, and my heart just wasn't in her idea, but I said I had another idea, and she grabbed onto that. So it's never a bad idea just to throw an idea out there, right?
Yeah.
Totally. You never know what will happen. You might get a yes. And if you get a no, and then maybe you find someone else who will do it. Like you said, Chronicle didn't want to publish that. You figured out another way. So
yeah, cool. I mean, I think it's really like, I think that's the whole thing of, there is luck involved with it. There is privilege involved with it. But I think that if you don't trust your own feelings about a project, like if you don't like elevate your own like curiosity and excitement to, you know, one of your highest priorities, it's like, no one else is going to do that for you. And so like, I think thing number one in your work is that like, if you get like a bad feeling about a proposal or a project, and you have the option of not taking it or like redirecting that energy into something you are excited about, like really letting your own like curiosity and excitement lead the way, I think it's like really key in like a lot of creative endeavors.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Yeah. And so then how did the planetarium book come about? Let's just talk about that briefly.
Oh, well, so the planetarium book is the book I worked on with Chronicle. So it started off being this book is a blank. And then we're like, okay, we're going to put different things in it. And then we just decided to call it This Book is a Planetarium because that seemed like the most absurd thing to call a book. Mm-hmm. But I like that it's such an absurd title, but then it's like you open it and you're like, wow, it actually is a planetarium. Like that kind of dynamic is, I think, like a good experience for readers. We finally got it out. There was a lot of difficulty and back and forth. I signed whatever the default contract was with Chronicle, which I think disempowered me more than I realized. I kind of thought contracts were just about money, but they're also about like who gets the final say in a design, in the paper engineering and all of this stuff. And so I had a hard time working with them, but it's mostly my fault for signing a bad contract, I think. So we took maybe 2 years to get it out. It took a really, really long time. We had all of this excitement and all of these pre-orders on Amazon, and we had to just toss them all away because we couldn't get the book published in time, which was very devastating to me because, you know, this is like my first book and, you know, the biggest project I've ever worked on. And so I was like, oh, this is the end of the world. And I was very upset. But
talk a little bit about the production and those issues with the paper engineering.
Yeah.
Was it cost related or?
The thing is that I am not completely sure. So the thing is like, when you sign a contract, that's disempowering. It just basically means that you don't really know why the decisions are being made, that you're just not a part of them.
Right.
And so I sent all of my prototypes off. So I sent physical prototypes that worked along with Dialine files, which are basically like Adobe Illustrator files that have cut lines, square lines, little glue areas and stuff. And I sent that all off and I was like, great. My job is done. Like, what else am I going to work on this year? And then it was just like, that was like the least of my work. So they sent back they recreated their own version of what I had sent. And it was like this weird game of telephone where I didn't even recognize the thing they sent back. Wow. And it was almost like it did work as a pop-up, but it didn't work as the devices. And so I would do extensive documentation of like, okay, here's my pop-up. It works this way. Yours doesn't work this way. I'd make diagrams and do all of these tests. But the one thing that we really, really got stuck on for like months and months was I kept on making these planetariums that opened up into this nice, like semi-spherical shape, you mm-hmm. know, which to me like connotes space, like those kinds of domes remind me of like planetariums and telescopes. And that's sort of what they're supposed to look like. But the printer kept on sending back these domes that didn't quite open. So they looked more like shark fins than a dome. And they worked fine. Like they projected the stars on the ceiling fine. But they didn't look like a planetarium. It didn't look like space to me. And so the publisher was all ready to go to press with these, and I had to be quite a diva and threaten to cancel the entire project until we figured out why their domes weren't domey enough. And it came down to this stupid thing. So like whenever you have a score mark in a piece of paper and you pre-crease it, by pre-crease, we don't have like a fixed definition for what that means. And so I was saying pre-creasing and they thought, okay, that means we should take our fingernail and crease it in one direction. But when I was making them, I was creasing them in both directions, which gives each one of those creases a higher level of hinginess, which allowed mm-hmm. the whole shape to open up into a dome. And so we tried different papers. We investigated different adhesives. Like I made all kinds of like how-to videos and documentation. It was like this intense thing. And then it came down to that stupid detail. So it was just that stupid detail that like held up the project for like 4 months.
Wow. But you were dealing with someone in like another state, right? So things were being sent back and forth. You weren't actually in the same room. I can see how that would happen. Yeah. It's really, you don't think sometimes about what you're doing. I mean, you don't say every little detail. And that sounds like something that just was never communicated. And
it was really upsetting to me because the printer was in Hong Kong and then my publisher was in San Francisco. And the publisher in San Francisco would never let me talk to the printer in Hong Kong directly. And so it was a real struggle because I was like, wait, did I not explain this well? Or did the publisher intercept what I said and gave them the information differently? Like, I still to this day don't know exactly what happened, but I do know that I just like poured 100 hours every week and trying to communicate how to make it. And it wasn't getting through and I wasn't allowed to like go there and like talk to the printer. And so I was like, I kind of like threw my hands in the air with them and I was like, I'm just going to cancel this whole project and do it myself if you all can't get get your act together, essentially.
Good for you. Good for you. Yeah. 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 I've had things like that where it's super frustrating. You've done so many projects, but I want to talk a little bit about your teaching and how that started and what you teach.
Yeah. Well, so I think that the first time I taught was like right out of grad school. They asked me to teach Pratt's pre-college program or art history, which was fun because it was like me and a bunch of 17-year-olds like running around on the subway to go see art in New York City.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. That was fun. But I hadn't taught again until my friend Zach Lieberman founded this artist-run school called the School for Poetic Computation, which is like over in West Beth. And Zach had invited me to talk to their students. And this happened twice. So I came in and like showed my work and talked to their students. And then I got invited back again the next year. And then when Trump got elected, I was really just feeling like this real need to feel good about people again. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I really needed to find community, that I had kind of been working in isolation and that I couldn't do that anymore, that I like had to find my people. And so I reached out to Zach at SFPC and said, like, I'm thinking about maybe being a student or something. And he's like, oh, it's funny. I had an email in my draft to you that I was going to ask you to teach as part of this program. And so I had imposter syndrome for a minute and I was like, wait a second. Okay. But he proposed, it was this track. It was called Crafting Material Logic. And it was all about this intersection of logic and computation with material and craft thinking. And I was able to work with my friend Pam Liu, who is really interested in like weaving and computation, and my friend Robbie Kraft, who is really interested in origami and computation. And we created this whole curricula, and it was a great experience. Like it was super joyful and really, really fun. And ever since then, I've like in these difficult times, like when COVID hit, like it's kind of, that's almost like my comfort food is like teaching, like convening a group of people and we're all interested in the same sort of like nerdy subject and then just kind of sharing things with each other. So like making different things, sharing different ideas, like having a discussion, like it feels like really good to me. So I know that's a weird thing to say about teaching. Like it's also a way of like getting deeper into the subject matter, trying to formalize like the ideas I've had about these different like craft subjects. But it's also just like a way to be together. And I think, you really can like make a good sense of community with people that are thinking about the same things with you.
Yeah. And you do a great job. I can attest to that because I took your class through, Cooper Union this past fall. And it was so great because it was offered on Zoom. So one benefit of the pandemic, because I wouldn't have taken this class. I wouldn't have come to New York to take this class that was 10 weeks long. But it was a fabulous class and a great community around the world. You get people from all over the place. And I love it. I loved it. So was that kind of an extension of the class at the School for Poetic Computation? And I just want to briefly mention the interesting forms that you introduced us to and then really encourage us to explore on our own, like the flexagon and the volvel and the Mobius strip and what else? I mean, it was just incredible. Slice forms.
Yeah. Well, I think when I first taught with Pan and Robbie at SFPC, like I just didn't know a whole lot, but I like really, really cramped for that class. And so I put together like a database of paper mechanisms and just like did a lot of research for that class. And out of that class, you know, we had a whole group of people who were interested in things. Like they brought in their own ideas and other weird Victorian devices they had seen and stuff. And so I kind of the classes are a good way. Like, I feel like the longer I teach, I'm almost like a, like I think of like a snowball, like rolling down the mountain. I just like keep on like gathering like other little pieces from other people. And so, I this is just like friends of friends of friends. Like, my friend Dan, runs a print shop called The Arm that I hang out in a whole lot. And, Dan is also the printing tech at Cooper Union. And so, at Cooper Union, this woman, Kara, runs the type at Cooper program. And she contacted me through Dan. She says, you know, I've been really interested in, you know, different forms of books that the students can make. So we do all of these type programs, but then like, what do they do with this type? And I talked to her on the phone and I sort of explained that, like, you know, I'm not really a book arts person. Like, I really have great admiration for book arts, but I don't have the patience or the craft skills to do intense binding or anything like that. But, you know, I told her what I was interested in and told her about this class at SFPC and send her the databases. And she's like, well, you know, let's give this a try. Like, it sounds interesting to me. Like, maybe it'll be interesting to other people. And I think, you know, whenever I'm a little bit nervous about, like, you know, is it going to fly or not? Like, I try to, you know, make fun Instagram posts or whatever to like get attention on it. And so I posted it and the class filled up almost immediately. And with a lot of people who I really admired. So people who were artists that I admired in other craft disciplines. So there's like an experimental ceramicist whose work I followed for a long time that signed up, and people I knew from the Movable Book Society signed up. And so it was really exciting. I'm sure you felt that feeling before when someone signs up for a class and you're like, wow, I've always wanted to meet that person. I admire their work so much. And it's like this combination of excitement and like fear, because you're like, oh yeah, I cannot fail them.
right. Yeah. I'm curious whether you had any training in teaching in graduate school, because I only have a BA, not even a BFA. So I studied art in college, but had zero training. And sometimes I think it's an interesting perspective to be coming from, like not knowing how to teach. I've taken lots of classes, I observed, but I don't know. Is that similar for you?
No one really ever taught me how to teach. And I don't know, like, I really liked a lot of my teachers in grad school, but like, most of them were practicing artists. And so they got the job because they were good at making their art, not necessarily because they were like the best teachers. But, and I think that's kind of like what grad school is. Like, I felt like the teachers, sort of treated us like peers, and I wasn't quite ready for that, you know? So, School for Poetic Computation definitely like had very intentional ideas about pedagogy and, how teaching should be carried out. And so I think I kind of was, a little bit subconsciously inspired by how they empower their students it's like a very non-hierarchical place. And so I think I learned a bit about teaching from them, and then like subsequently have read things like Paulo Freire's like Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I know that everything I sort of do as like a designer and in my own work is kind of for myself. And so when I was thinking like, oh, paper engineering over Zoom, we're meeting for 3 hours every week, I was like, how can we keep those 3 hours interesting? And the one answer I came up with for that is just vary the activities, you know, make sure everyone has the chance and the comfort to speak up. So it's not just like me talking at this group of people for 3 hours. Make sure there are readings, make sure we're like watching videos, make sure we're making things, because otherwise, I don't know, 3 hours is a really, really, really long time to stare at your computer, especially if you've been working all day. And so that was the main thing I was thinking about, and like what to do with this class was like just almost like an entertainment on an entertainment level, like how could I keep everyone happy?
Yeah, it's really true on Zoom, and getting people to talk is tricky. Yeah, sometimes.
But it's so boring for everyone if only one person's talking the whole time.
I agree. Totally. okay, so what are you working on now?
Well, the big project I've been working on during the pandemic is a book with Letterform Archive. They're a graphic design archive that's based in San Francisco. And we decided in 2019, after they published their first book with their new publishing program, that I was going to be the next book, that we were going to work on a book about letter forms. And so what we agreed to do was a pop-up ABC book. And so it goes from the letter A to the letter Z, everything's a pop-up in between. I started thinking about what to do with this, how to take advantage of their collection, and also to take advantage of like what I uniquely could bring to it. And we decided to make it a book that was about typography, like the history of typography and technology and how those things go together. So, you know, every letter you see in the world, you know, there's lots of different typefaces. They're in all kinds of different styles. They remind us of different things. You know, some things look 1960s mod, some things look like they could be like from the Roman Empire. You know, why do we have those associations? Where do those associations come from? And so the book is about that, about like how these letter forms sort of like get their flavor from the technology that have produced them, and also the aesthetic, visual, philosophical climate that produced these different typefaces. But, you know, the pandemic has slowed us down a little bit. There's been the Letterform Archive moved. They've been working on all of these projects to address inadequacies in their collection, questions that were raised during Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're getting the book done, but we're in like the editing process still. So I don't know if it's going to come out this year or next year, hopefully this year, but who knows?
Does it have a title?
It's called Alphabet in Motion, a pop-up book for typophiles.
And it sounds like it's going to have some text. Are you writing that or someone else?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm writing it. I am not the best writer, but I wrote, over the pandemic, I wrote like 40 or 50,000 words. So a lot of essays about type and technology. I'm actually on this Friday, I'm teaching a class at ITP with all of this new knowledge I have about type and technology. So see how that goes.
Oh, cool. I'm really interested in this because when I first got interested in paper, I discovered a font in a Letraset catalog, you know, those old printed catalogs that were full of fonts, and it was called Block Up. And it was a three-dimensional font, but it was flat on the page, right? So, and I figured out how to engineer it into three dimensions. I'm going to show you after we get off.
Oh my gosh. So
and
cool.
It's just kind of lingered throughout my career. I have never really done anything with it, but other than like put it in my book, my new book that's coming out.
Wait, what new book?
Share it with
coming
other
out?
People. The Art of Papercraft.
Cool.
And I'm sorry like I wasn't in touch with you before. You would have been in it if I had known you better. But anyways. So, all right, we need to wind down, but I wanted to just, you had a few recommendations, and let's start. You mentioned the School for Poetic Computation, and you have that in your recommendations. The local communities are important to you. So, and you've mentioned several of these, but I want you to tell me what the School of Poetic Computation is, like who goes there and what you can.
Yeah. So, they're an artist run school. And okay. So they were founded by by a couple people who recently like stepped down and now former students are running it. But it sort of started as like a competitor to ITP at NYU. So ITP at NYU is sort of like this famous like art and technology program. And they started at SFPC as sort of like a low cost, program that would like work with people who were professionals who could perhaps like take a summer off or a month off, but not like enroll in a graduate program. And so it's basically, it's hard to describe because it kind of like takes the shape of the artists who are coming up with the curriculum. And so there are artists who like have classes about the connection between the history of like weaving and handicraft and computers. And, you know, we taught a program that's about like papers and like papers' capacity to create logical structures like vowels, for example. And so it's kind of fun. There's like they had an anthropologist teaching there. And so it's all stuff that like artists would be interested in, but like the type of artists who are like super curious about the world and are interested in technology, but also like have the capacity to be critical of technology. And so I think the people who go there are, you know, people, there are a lot of people who, you know, had worked in tech previously that didn't want to anymore. And so I think they attract a lot of people who, you know, start off, they went to school for computer science and then realized that, you know, big tech was corrupt in like whatever way. And we're kind of rethinking about like how they could use their skills in a more humanistic way. But yeah, they do a lot of interesting things. I also, there's a lot of little interconnected communities like that in New York where I would say that the thread that runs through it is that we're all kind of nerdy about art, zines and books, and we're all interested in tech. Like no one is really like a total Luddite that's a member of these communities, but I would definitely say like SFPC is really interesting to me. Baby Castles, which is kind of like the worst name in the world, but they're great. Like they do a really interesting lecture series called Word Hack. And they have like little grants for people who are working in video game art. There's also Soft Surplus, which is like a collective workspace that my friend Melanie Hoff runs. And they do a lot of events and like host scene fairs and things like that. So it's kind of like, you know, the art scene in New York rent is very high here. And so it's hard for people to make these little scrappy spaces that aren't very clearly defined as a business,
right.
You know, that are sort of like, they kind of work on the fringes of capitalism. And so I feel really lucky that I've been able to like fall in with those kinds of things in New York, but there's probably more. I mean, there's probably more little communities in New York that I don't know about, but certainly in cities like, you know, Pittsburgh or New Orleans, San Francisco, like I definitely know there are little art communities in those places that, you know, because you graduate from art school and you're like, okay, now what? Like, where's my home? Where's my people? And you can kind of like, some people do manage to stay in touch with the people they went to school with, but for me, I liked and have some friends from grad school, but like I didn't have that feeling of like, oh, these are my people. Like I didn't really connect with anyone at art school like on that spiritual level. But something about SFPC, like I think it came right into my life when I needed it, and really connected with those people and made a lot of friends there. So,
yeah, cool. And you wanted to recommend the Small Press Movement and the Risograph. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of connected too. So I guess like over the past like 15 years, like the Risograph has really had its time in the sun. So a Risograph, it's a Japanese it almost looks like a Xerox machine, but it works kind of like a silkscreen machine. And it was
related to the GoCo at all?
I think it's the same company that makes them.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is like a relationship between Rizzo and GoCo, but Rizzo is like this big, enormous, like beige machine, and GoCo is like a smaller little silk screen thing. But yeah, the Rizzo has made it pretty fast and easy for people to publish like zines and books. And so if anyone has ever been to the New York Book Fair, you'll know how overwhelming it is that there's tons of like small presses, there are tons of artists who are working on their own publishing endeavors. And it really represents the gamut of like niches and subcultures. And like, so they call it sort of like the small press publishing. I don't know if it's a revolution, but there's definitely been like more and more of it like over the past decade or so. And it's great because it means that there's not the same like barrier of entry into publishing. And so like normally in order to publish, you'd have to have like a publisher and a contract. And this is a way that like I guess like traditionally more like structurally marginalized groups can publish things. And so they have different small press publishers that, you know, have different areas of interest. But for example, the Arm, where I oftentimes go and print, you know, they print all kinds of things there. So like all kinds of like interesting people from all over the world come in with their projects and say like, oh, I want to make a book. And then they try to help them figure out how to like make that happen. So it's very scrappy, kind of like low margin kind of industry, but it definitely is very vibrant right now. And I think even, and maybe especially in pandemic times, like it's a good way for people to keep in touch with each other just by making these little books and zines.
Right. I'm just having a flashback to, I worked for a huge commercial printer when I moved to New York City in the late 1980s. And I'm thinking about the difference between like just going there and having something printed, because we did, you know, annual reports and huge jobs. So part of it is the quantity, but there was a small print shop within that did smaller projects. And so there's a community aspect too, to the small press movement that is lacking in these bigger organizations, I guess.
Did you notice that like what the big printer, like the jobs were different? Could you tell like when you're working there that like the types of jobs that the big printer printed and the small printer printed were different?
Yeah, I think they were in, it's so long ago, I don't know. And I remember I wanted to have something printed and the small printer did that for me. But I think the big printer probably sent smaller jobs to the smaller printer. So this particular small printer was not a community, like you're saying. He was doing the same kind of work, but just on a smaller scale.
Oh, okay.
And maybe it even grew out of the big company. I don't know. So it wasn't really a small press.
Well, I'm happy they printed your project for you.
Yeah. Okay, and I want to wrap up just with bicycling, because I actually, when I moved to New York, it probably took a couple of years, but I started leading bicycle tours through the American Youth Hostel, had a program, and you know, I was searching for my community at that time. I was in my 20s. I think it took a good 2 years to find people, but one of the things was bicycling, and then I met all these people that commuted by bike. So I started biking to work over the Brooklyn Bridge because I lived in Brooklyn, and joined Transportation Alternatives, which
they're great.
Yeah. And I remember designing their newsletter header, the bicycle letter. I still have my design. It was used maybe for a year. I don't know. Anyways, so how did you get into biking? Have you always biked?
No, I didn't. I lived in Park Slope and I went to grad school in Clinton Hill, and that involved like the F train and the G train. And I think one day I realized like, oh, is this taking me 45 minutes every day? If I hopped on a bike, it would theoretically be 15 minutes. And so I had heard like New York City is so dangerous. It's scary. There are cars, you know? And so I was like, I don't know, can I do it? But I did it once and I got addicted very quickly. And I was like, this is the way to get around the city. And I still feel that way. Like I have lived here for almost 20 years and I just very rarely take the subway. I bike pretty much everywhere. And I don't understand how people, I don't know how people like live in the city without biking everywhere. It's just so great. Like you get out, you get fresh air, you get to see what's going on in your neighborhood. You can see the waterfront. It makes me happy. Like going down in the subway, like I love that we have public transportation. I love that we have a subway system, but I never want to take it. Like you have to wait for the train. I don't know. Like I hate waiting.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I totally, once I discovered commuting by bike, it was like, I saw so many things that I didn't even know existed between point A and B when I was underneath the ground on the subway. Right. So, and if you live in Manhattan, you can take the bus and then you have this, the sight experience, but yeah, being outside, the exercise, saving the time. I actually, with transportation alternatives, we did a contest one time from a point in Brooklyn to a point in Manhattan. A subway rider, a car driver, and a bicyclist.
I'm familiar with this. Yeah.
I was the bicyclist. And
oh my God, Helen, you're so cool.
Me and the subway commuter arrived at the same time, and the car was way behind us. So that was fun.
Surprise me.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real treat to talk to you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me.
And where can people find you online?
I'm most active on Instagram. I'm Kelly Anderson on Instagram, KelliAnderson. I occasionally post on Twitter, and I have hopes that this year I'm going to redo my website and, you know, integrate all of the old content into a more modern form. So hopefully this is my year that that's actually going to happen after 15 years.
Yay. Well, congratulations on all you're doing, and thank you for all your contributions to the world of paper and so much more.
Oh, likewise. I really appreciate everything you do, Helen. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here. And the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the main contain-